Well, with habitats that range from wetlands to prairies to forests to savannas, no wonder that here in Wisconsin we enjoy such a rich diversity of wildlife. And whether you're born in the state like me or maybe you adopted it later on, like Judith, our producer, I'm betting that you appreciate how much our wildlife and natural areas mean to life here in the state. Larry Mueller here, really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven back, comes by once a month to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's going on out there. Great to have you with us, Scott. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's especially nice to be roaming around Wisconsin in October. It's just so nice here. I can't imagine a better month. And after 2 weeks ago, I made the semi-mistake of traveling down to Arizona to see that Arizona State Badger football game, which was... That was a desperate situation, but I'll tell you what, although the desert has some redeeming beauty and so forth, coming back to a more moist climate with
green
green and seasonal change, distinct seasonal changes and all, it was it's just great.
Oh, yeah. With that seasonal change, of course, we've got fall garden cleanup and winter animal proofing to think about.
You know, at least for now, Larry, at least in my garden, things are still producing pretty well. I mean, there's not a frost in sight. It may get cool next week finally, but I still don't see any frost in the long-range forecast. So there's still lots of tomatoes and raspberries and cucumbers and assorted other things. So fall garden cleanup may be delayed a little bit, but it will become important at some point. And I think this just speaks to people getting their, not only their gardens, but their yards, their homes, their landscaping and everything else secured for the winter to prevent some potentially nasty animal problems. If you've got things that tend to like to get in the house, of course, there's the annual fall invasion of deer mice and white-footed mice into the garages and squirrels into the soffits and things like that. But there are a lot of things you can do to protect your landscape plants by adequately fencing or guarding them with various types of wire or repellents, or by reducing some of these animal populations like voles, for example, now rather than after snow flies when you can't get at them, and avoiding a lot of heartache come spring next year when you go out and say, oh my gosh, I should have protected that burning bush, or I should have fenced that dwarf apple tree I just planted, or whatever. You have to do it now if you want to prevent the damage from occurring over winter.
Yeah. How do you get rid of the voles? Mouse traps?
Well, this time of year around a composted landscaping plot, for example, you could put out a grid of mouse traps, but there are also some very good rodenticides targeted at voles that if you learn how to place them appropriately so that they're not causing any problem or non-target birds or mammals, you can reduce the vole population pretty effectively and again, get after them before they're protected by the blanket of snow. That's the other interesting thing you mentioned in the intro. These animals are also getting ready for winter. So the strategies that our Wisconsin species have are either get the heck out of here, like many of our birds are doing right now, and a few other things like some of the bats, those that have the capability for migrating, leave. Those that don't either have to essentially den up and wait it out, such as those animals that hibernate or enter at least some state of dormancy over the winter. And then the rest really have to adapt to the winter conditions and tough it out. So the deer and the raccoons and the squirrels and many of our feeder songbirds and all simply adapt to winter weather and they're here. But one needs to consider the species that might be considering problems or causing problems and then figure out whether they remain active or not. Moles, for example, are still here, but they go down in the soil column to stay below the frost line. So assuming we have good frost penetration, you don't have to worry about moles again until next spring. So it's all part of understanding a little bit about the animals and what makes them tick and their activity patterns, and you can avoid a lot of heartache around the home.
You surely can. Scott Craven, our guest. Paul in Prairie du Chien has a question for you, Scott. Let's go to Paul. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wondering about a problem that seems to be occurring in northeast Iowa, and there also have been cases in Wisconsin with this epizootic hemorrhagic disease. And is another name for that blue tongue, perhaps?
Well, it's related to blue tongue, which is a livestock affliction, but it's a similar problem.
Some friends that live over in Iowa have been finding deer around water sources dead, multiple numbers, Calmer, Iowa, Marquette, McGregor area. And I'm just wondering if that is it's going to be a serious outbreak. They're finding, 10, 15 animals around these waterways.
The longer it stays warm, the worse it could potentially be. EHD is a huge problem the further south you go from Wisconsin, and there are periodic outbreaks here. When it happens, there can be considerable local mortality, the way you describe it with your friends in Iowa. The last outbreak that I had anything to do with was back 10 years ago when chronic wasting disease was discovered. And at the same time, there were some EHD problems on several properties where I know the landowners just west of Madison. And it got to the point on one private property where the owner's wife would no longer go out and walk on their hiking trails because there were so many rotting deer carcasses that was just overpowering. And I think he found some 30 carcasses on that one property. Now, the deer have recovered from that. In that setting, and they will from any particular outbreak, but it can be very disconcerting when it happens. And they usually are found around water where they go for water, and the problem is carried by black flies and whatnot that spread it amongst the deer. So
it's black flies. Oh.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen how much of a problem it is here, but it's usually when it does happen, it's in the southern part of the state, and if you start to go into the southeastern United States, it's a much bigger problem.
And when we hit the cold, freezing and so forth.
Once we hit freezing, that should be the end of it for the season.
Yeah. So there you go, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question or comment for our guests. What's the wild activity you've been noticing or anything different for you this year? Questions about the hunting season or favorite place to view wildlife? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Email from Jeff and Rhinelander, who said, I read the rules that say that only one firearm is allowed between the youth and the mentor. I have a concealed carry permit. Can I still have that weapon while in the woods and deer stand? So he's talking about he's in this mentor program.
That's a sticky one. I'm not sure which regulation trumps the other one. Presumably a concealed carry firearm might not be an appropriate hunting firearm anyway. It's a small some of these lightweight, it could be a 22, it could be a lightweight 9mm or 38 or whatever. I don't know what they have, but it might not be an appropriate firearm anyway. I guess I just wonder what would be the compelling need to carry the concealed firearm while hunting in a mentor situation anyway.
Yeah.
But that's a question that's going to have to either go to local law enforcement or the local conservation officer and get a ruling, because I'm not sure which law takes precedent.
Yeah, it was me, and it's, the youth deer hunt is this weekend. If I was going out, I think even if I had a concealed carry permit, I'd say caution on the side of leaving it in the car or someplace else and not carrying it.
Yeah, leave it somewhere else. There's probably no need for it anyway, and why
bother?
Complicate the issue? You've got the firearm that's appropriate for the youth to take a deer, so hey, stick with it.
Stick with it. Marshall in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Marshall.
Yes, Scott Marshall Hanks here calling. What's the latest with white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin?
Wow, haven't heard from you for a long time.
Yes, it has been. I'm just traveling. I'm up in Duluth right now, and I happen to turn the radio on and thought I'd just call in and ask that question.
Well, the last map that was forwarded to me by the BAT team over at the DNR, and I get those fairly regularly, was maybe 2 weeks ago. And it was a little disturbing to see the distribution of the disease in the eastern United States, east of the Mississippi. It was virtually everywhere, and into southern Canada. Interestingly enough, the only two remaining white nose free states are Wisconsin and Michigan, and we're rapidly becoming surrounded. So, I mean, the good news is that our bat team has done everything humanly possible to promulgate appropriate regulations to control the caves and hibernaculum and people in and out and equipment in and out, and do whatever they can to get ready for its arrival. But I think most everyone's resigned to the fact that we will discover it eventually, and then how serious a toll it will take is uncertain. But at least for right now, we're still WNS free. There have been some other accounts. I saw another account about the endangered Indiana bat, where I think the speculation now is that white nose syndrome will take out virtually that entire population. It was something like 80 or 90% of the population of those particular bats. So it certainly has the potential to do a lot of damage. It already has done a lot of damage in some of the eastern states. And when you consider that the discovery in New York was only 7 years ago in 2006, it has spread remarkably rapidly. And as I said, I just don't see how we can avoid it completely here for much longer, unfortunately.
And Marshall, stay listening. Marge in Cataract has a question that relates to it. Marge, hi. Thank you for calling. Marge, are you there? We lose her?
Uh-oh.
I lost Marge.
Marge is gone.
Lost Marge. Well, I'll tell you what. We will go to Peggy in Duluth. Peggy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my... It's more of a comment than a question. I work with a wildlife rehabilitation organization in Duluth, and I just wanted to comment on the use of rodenticides and other poisons. The problem with rodenticides is they cause secondary poisoning of predator species such as owls, other raptors, and even foxes. So I would urge the listeners not to use poisons of any kind, in particular rodenticides, to control rodent issues.
Well, that's kind of a blanket statement, which I think is so blanket as to be almost useless, because to pin all rodenticides into the same category is, I think, a little simplistic. There are many different categories of rodenticides, and there are many very good guidelines in terms of how they're used, so that they certainly do have validity in some settings. Now, certainly broadcast spreading of any pesticide, including rodenticides, on the landscape, not paying any attention to label regulations, toxicity, or targets would be downright stupid.
Yeah.
But to simply remove all rodenticides from the toolbox in terms of controlling pest problems because of secondary poisoning, which with proper use and application can largely be avoided, I think is a much better approach to think about it.
So. Okay. All right. Thanks, Peggy. Dave in Duluth, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. I've been climbing pine trees for 40-some years, banning baby bald eagles, and I've developed a rather strong antipathy towards pine pitch. And I've got gray squirrels and red squirrels at my house that are eating fresh spruce cones that are just full of pitch. Is there something in their saliva that cuts that stickiness out, or how do they deal with that?
Boy, that is, we've been doing that this a long time, Dave.
That's
and I don't remember a more interesting question, and certainly not that one for all the years we've been doing this. Now, let me figure this out. Certainly the cones are dismantled readily, particularly by red squirrels, to get at the seeds, but I have to assume that, much like many other things when it comes to wildlife, that their capabilities are, kind of almost beyond our comprehension in some cases. I'm simply speculating that those animals are capable of avoiding the pitch to the point that it's not a serious problem. I don't think they're ingesting it. I think they're able to get those cone scales off or choose appropriate cones that are not pitch saturated. In order to,
you pick them up. In
they're
my
all
yard.
They're every all covered. One every one of them is covered. Well,
yeah. You can't pick them up without getting pitch.
Well, then I can't give you a good answer. But my speculation is that they're capable and dexterous enough to either avoid that pitch, close to entirely, or have some way to get it off of their fur, their paws, their teeth, or whatever, so that it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Because they certainly are very proficient at
yeah.
nipping cones off the trees, going down, gathering them up, collecting the seeds, and in the case of red squirrels, storing huge quantities of them. And there's no... You know, there's nothing that I've ever seen in the literature or reports of, hey, I just went outside and there's a squirrel completely gooed up with spruce pitch and it can't move and I'm trying to clean it off kind of thing. So yeah. I just think they're simply capable of avoiding it.
There you go. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, emeritus wildlife specialist with UW Extension, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Always great to have him with us. Just to mention, coming up at 1 o'clock today, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon, John Dean, joins Kathleen Dunn to talk about his days in Washington. The Watergate hearings, ethics in government, that's today at 1 here on the Ideas Network. But, of course, right now, we're dealing with wildlife with Scott Craven. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have a great wildlife photo you want to post, I hope you'll do that. Just go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Marge in Cataract back. Marge, hi. Thank you for calling. Marge, are you there? We are having...
That was our second shot at Marge.
That was our second try,
well,
try at Marge, and for some reason, she's not coming through.
Well, but maybe she can hear, and the question deals with apparently she found some dead bats this summer and was just interested in the cause, and to be honest, not knowing, you know, if we're talking about hundreds of bats or just a couple, no idea. During the summer, usually the breeding, the peak of reproduction is from, and the period during which people cannot bat-proof structures is from June 1st to August 15th. That's when young bats are taken to the wing. They get into all sorts of trouble, get into a place where they desiccate, get tangled up in something. There could be a whole host of reasons, but it's not necessarily an issue. When people find dead animals, I think they're usually looking for an explanation that there's some sort of disease or calamity, and in many cases, that's not the case. So,
yeah, there you go. Jeff and Merrill, we go to you next. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I was wondering if you could maybe give me some explanation. I was in the woods last, it was about the middle of January, and I came across on one of my woods roads about a 300 to 400 yard stretch of wolf tracks. There was at least three different size wolves for sure that I could see. And it was just, it was totally trampled down with tracks. There was no blood or, you know, anything where it looked as where they may have tried to have killed something there. And I was just wondering if maybe there could be an explanation as far as if that was like a mating ritual maybe, or if they were just playing or what that could have been.
Yeah.
Well, or couple of possibilities. That a stretch of road may have just been a convenient place for the animals to be traveling, but they also have, in terms of their social behavior, what are called rendezvous sites where the animals get together periodically and reunite as far as whatever the pack activity happens to be. So it could have been a rendezvous site. It could have been just a particularly favored site at the time where they were hunting but didn't make a kill. And there are probably other explanations as well, but, you know, a neat thing to come across, at least. Yeah, and yeah. I'm guessing that it was something to do with their social behavior at the time or potentially the interaction on the border of a couple of pack territories or, you know, possibly some other explanations.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Jeff. And we've got wolf hunting and trapping. That's, what, October 15th, something like that?
Yes, the second wolf hunting season, wolf hunting and trapping season begins on October 15th, which certainly isn't too far away. It will continue until either the February closing date is reached or, again, like occurred last year, all of the zones reach their harvest quotas and are closed by the DNR. So the quota is 251 animals this year, and there were 2,510 permits issued to capture or shoot those 251 animals, and it'll be interesting to see whether the hunters and trappers are as effective, as surprisingly effective as they were last year in terms of taking the allowable quota and assuring that the season was closed much earlier than anybody anticipated last year. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it plays out.
And, you know, there's a story I think that's kind of related in a way, and that's the bear dogs. There's a record number of bear dogs that were killed this season.
Yeah, and that's an ongoing thing. According to a little article in the paper this morning, it was kind of interesting. Anyway, according to the DNR's dog depredation report, 23 hounds had been killed by wolves while being used to hunt bears or being used to train bear dogs since June 3rd, which was a tie of the record number killed in 2006. And there were also three pet dogs that had been recorded killed. But 23 bear hounds is a lot. And they go on to explain a number of different possibilities as to why that's occurring and why the wolves are interacting with bear hounds to the point that, of course, bear hounds are killed in other ways, too. Bears occasionally kill bear hounds as well. But in this case, they're killed by wolves, and then there's compensation available for the owners of the hounds, up to $2,500 from the state per hound. And they go on to say that not all of the victims receive or even ask for that full amount. By the way, since there was a lot of controversy last year in actually using dogs to hunt wolves, which I think would speak to the fact that here's essentially collateral damage on the bear hounds. If the dogs were actually pursuing bears, wolves rather, you know, who knows what would happen. But if ever wolves or dogs are used to hunt wolves, then they would not be eligible for compensation. But I think the dog issue is still tied up in the court situation, but I'm not sure about that.
It is an interesting point that actually hunters could actually be given money from the state for a dog that they had sent out to hunt.
Well, that opens up a whole can of worms about, you know, where does responsibility for this lie with the dog owner, with the hunters, with society, with the DNR. But that's a can of worms that maybe we don't want to pop the top off of right now.
Yeah, it's probably not a bad idea to let that one go for maybe a whole show sometime. Yeah. Doug in Winneconne, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a volunteer hunter safety instructor here in Wisconsin. And as far as the mentor hunt goes, a concealed permit does not allow you to carry another weapon.
Okay, excellent.
You can only have one weapon between the hunter and the mentor.
Okay, excellent. So forget about your concealed carry permit is negated for the purposes of mentor hunting. So
all
that's,
right.
that's fine.
Correct.
Good.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Okay. Appreciate getting that cleared up right today.
Well, it's good to have it cleared up, and I think it's probably the right course of action.
The right course of action.
That's given the government activity right now. It's nice to see the right course of action pursued once in a while.
Helen in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Well, the question the woman called in with about, you know, dead bats and, you know, the whole idea of we want to know how animals die or why. Made me think about the fact that I have a large wooded lot. I have a ton of squirrels. I feed the crows. I have just a ton of animals in my yard and all of the yards around us. And other than squashed on the highway, I rarely see a dead animal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they die. I know that a lot of the animals in my yards are fairly old because they're well taken care of. I never see them keel over from old age, and I never see dead animals in my yard or anywhere around. And so it kind of makes me curious. I know nature has a way of cleaning these things up, but, you know, tons of them have to die every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious where they go.
Well, you know, I think most people come in contact with dead wildlife in just a couple of ways. One is what we see on the highways, and certainly the carnage on states' highways is awful, but I don't see anything changing in any meaningful way on that because animals travel along or across our highways, and people are going to continue driving. And if we raise the speed limit and so forth, I mean, it's just going to continue. Occasionally, I don't want to pop the can off another can of worms here, but of course, dead small mammals and birds are frequently brought back into people's homes by pets, particularly cats. So there are a couple of ways people come in contact with these things, but you're right. It's not like on a walk you're going to find many dead things lying around for a couple reasons. Number one, if they do die, they're usually picked up fairly quickly by some other animal that views it as an easy meal. And there are a number of cases where this kind of thing has been explored, for example, where researchers are interested in mortality of birds or bats around wind turbines or around TV tower guy wires and things like that. They actually do some studies on how fast the carcasses disappear or how difficult they are to find. And it's amazing how fast these things are picked up by scavengers and predators, much like the roadkill eventually disappears mm-hmm. too, thanks to crows and vultures and anything else passing by. So a dead animal is, if it does die, A, it may be virtually invisible, given the amount of vegetation and cover out there. And even if it isn't, they're picked up fairly quickly. And even a large carcass, like a deer, back when there were a number of things going on related to chronic wasting disease, one of the studies was dealing with how long a deer carcass remained on the landscape. And they were actually chaining some dead deer to a tree or whatever and then monitoring, hey, how long did this thing sit there? And it was remarkable how fast. A, it was remarkable how many different things visited the carcass for a snack, from chickadees to eagles to dogs and foxes and possums and everything you could think of. But in some cases, in only a matter of 2 weeks, boom, it was gone. Everything gone. So there are a couple of reasons why, even though there are many animals out there, and the reality, although we may not like to think about it, is that most wild animals are destined to die a violent death rather than just simply passing away of old age. We just don't see it happen very often, and we don't find the results of it very often, and that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. It is amazing. And if you're a deer hunter, for example, many deer hunters, I'm sure, have shot a deer and then the next day or even later that day with the gut pile sitting there. It is amazing how quickly things come and visit and that those gut piles just go away.
Yep, very quickly.
Very, very quickly. Linnell and Kimberly, hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question really is kind of just a personal interest kind of thing. The mallard duck population in Wisconsin, I was just wondering how healthy it is. I don't seem to see as many of them around as even 10 years ago, so I was just curious as to if there's anything going on with the population that might be making my perception maybe possibly reality.
Well, there are a couple of things to think about here. When you talk about duck populations in a state like Wisconsin, one issue is the resident duck population, the ducks that are actually living and breeding in Wisconsin. And then the other issue is the continental duck population and how many ducks might be migrating through or past us or whatever. Generally speaking, duck populations are in fantastic shape. I think this year wasn't quite as high as last year. I think the total continental population last year was in the neighborhood of 48 million. I think it was down to something like 45 million this year, give or take a couple million. I'm loose with the figures here. But it was pretty close, I think, to the second highest on record since surveys were taken, and I think that dates back to the 1950s. So continentally, in a large part because of habitat conditions and adequate water and assorted other things, that duck populations are doing as well as they ever have. In Wisconsin, it's my impression that the mallard population has been doing pretty well. The duck that has suffered over the last couple of decades is the blue-winged teal. Blue-winged teal, mallards, and wood ducks are the primary contribution to waterfowl populations in this state as far as hunters are concerned. I think mallards are doing okay, and I'm just trying to think of where I'm trying to refer you to a little article on this. One of the DNR research staff, a fellow named Ron Gaddy, has been studying duck populations, particularly teal, for some time. I want to say it was in the recent issue of the DNR magazine. I could be wrong about that. It's either in the DNR magazine or the most recent issue of Outdoor News, the newspaper format, and it may be in both. But Ron had a bit of a summary of some of his studies dealing with how those big three ducks had been doing in Wisconsin, with emphasis on the blueing teal. And I think if you're concerned about duck populations locally, that would be a darn good thing to dig out.
Okay. Well, I appreciate
Overall, ducks are in really good shape.
Exactly. Sorry for talking over you.
That's okay.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the information.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Maggie in Blue River next with a question. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I wanted to recommend a book by my favorite author, Bernd Heinrich. It's called Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. He's written many, many books, which are equally fascinating. And this one, if you just read the first paragraph, I think you're hooked for the whole book. So if anybody's interested in what happens to wildlife when they die, Bernd Heinrich is a real observer and a great naturalist. He's an entomologist who's become one of the leading authorities on ravens and other birds. So he's a wonderful guy. So that's all I wanted to say.
And what's the title? It's
Animal Way of Death?
It's called Life Everlasting.
Oh, that's right.
And then the subtitle is The Animal Way of Death. And his last name, his first name is Bernd Heinrich. Anything by Bernd Heinrich is a gem, a beautiful book.
Maggie, how would you summarize his conclusion as far as animals dying?
Well, one thing I can conclude is that in summertime things disappear almost instantly, and in winter they last longer.
Right.
And all kinds of, as you said, you went into it quite a bit, but there's tons and tons of interesting insects. And, of course, he's an entomologist, so he describes insects so beautifully. And then other things come along, and if the insects don't make it for one reason or another, then the rodents will be there. And if the rodents aren't there for one reason or another, a lot of things interact on carcasses. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
It is that.
And the other reality is that everything eats something. And if you're not a herbivore, then you're looking for animal matter in whatever form you can find it. And think about any of these populations, Larry, that go through their reproductive phase in the summer. So the deer herd, for example, reaches its annual peak right after fawn drops, probably mid-June, somewhere in there. So we have as many deer as we ever have on the landscape, or wolves or any other animal, at right about that point in early summer. And then you know that somehow we're going to get back to about that population come next summer.
Yeah.
With some fluctuation for populations that are increasing or decreasing. So all of that surplus, essentially, that has to get us back to the breeding population after winter, something's going to happen to those.
Yeah.
And in the case of deer, the DNR is involved in some really interesting mortality studies right now, trying to tease out, you know, how much of the loss of that breeding population to breeding population, all those extra deer that are produced every year, where the heck are they going? Now, a lot of them are going into the freezers of hunters. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are ending up dead on the highway, and there are disease issues, there are predation issues that are coming into play. Something happens to those animals. They die, and how they die depends on the species, but they do.
And Maggie, thanks again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Brian and Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how are you? I'm curious to know what effects the toxins coming out of the Pinoki mine might have on the wildlife in that area. Like what specific animals would be more prone to effect, and what would that look like in the animal?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's probably a
Brian.
I
can't give you a good answer for that, but I'm guessing that the environmental impact work and the reports on the siting of this mine and the permitting and everything else contain data on that. My guess is that it's those animals in the aquatic environment, be it fish, amphibians, things like that, are likely to be most affected, but how much they will be affected and which species. I've been trying to personally stay out of that mess in terms of that mine issue, so I can't tell you. But I think if you do a little internet work on the sighting of that mine or any mine in the upper Midwest, there would have to be a section in there exploring potential mortality or detrimental impacts on fish and wildlife populations.
Yeah. Well, you think just the actual hole of somebody that runs from Bob Madison to Janesville, that's
certainly
have an impact on...
Certainly whatever habitat is removed because of the surface area of the mine is gone, and therefore any animals living there have lost a home. Some are quite capable of moving on and finding habitat elsewhere. Some probably not, but how much of a factor that will be, I don't know.
Let's take some more calls. Ben in Fox Cities will turn to you next. Hi, Ben. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the great programs, not just this one, but all of them. I learned so much. People always look at me and say, how'd you learn that? And I always reference you guys.
Thank you.
I thought of a question while I was on hold, but the reason I called, purchasing a home, it's kind of, been not taken care of the best, and it's got a defunct fireplace and a chimney, and I wanted to seal that chimney off for pest reasons as well as, other reasons, and I didn't, I wondered if bats make homes in chimneys. I didn't want to seal them up in there, for dead animals in the chimney, and mm-hmm. I don't want to kill the bats. So I wondered if that's something to concern, or they don't really live in chimneys, or how do I get them out of there before I seal it up? And
well,
if I can ask a second question, and then I'll listen off phone.
Okay.
When you drive around and you see Canadian geese overrunning one pond, and then 10 feet down there's a pond with not one single one around it, what makes that happen? I'm just curious.
Why are the Canada geese in one pond and not the other?
Let's deal with the bats first.
Okay.
Well, bats will certainly get into chimneys on occasion. And, my cabin up in Bryce County is a case in point. We have a wood-burning fireplace as a heat source. And it's pretty common if we leave that for a period of time that... let's say when we bought the place, for example, like you're thinking about buying a place, I said, oh man, the fireplace is a mess. I've got to clean it out. I think in that first occasion, there were 17 or 18 dead bats mixed in with the ashes and paper and whatever
wow.
that were left in the fireplace. So part of the problem is that if they get down in the chimney and work their way through the flue and whatnot or the dampers, they're trapped and then they're going to die in there. So... upshot of the whole thing is an animal-proof cap on a chimney, not just for bats, but for a whole variety
raccoons.
Of things. Raccoons and whatever else, to save any unwanted mortality on the animals and any unwanted heartache on your part of having a litter of raccoons above your damper or whatever, which is going to get expensive to deal with, an animal-proof chimney cap is a great idea. I used to describe it as like that old Fram oil filter ad on TV. You know, hey, pay me now or pay me later. Either buy an $8 oil filter or you're going to replace your engine. Well, that's pretty much the case with animals and chimneys. If you don't cap the chimney for a few bucks, sooner or later you're going to have animals in there like raccoons that you don't want to deal with. And to call the Acme Raccoon Removal Service at $100 an animal, it's going to get costly. So... Ben, you're right on. You should seal or cap the chimney. If it's going to be a working fireplace in the future, an animal-proof cap that allows smoke and whatnot to get out but animals to not get in can be professionally installed. It's not that expensive. If you're going to cap it entirely, as I think you described, then just wait, depending on where you are in the state, until we've had a couple good hard freezes. And that will drive the bats that are going to hibernate out of the state and the other bats into their hibernacula, probably not in the chimney. And then that's about as safe a situation as you can be, or safe a position as you can be in, to go ahead and cap the chimney, seal it off, without fear of trapping bats. If you want to make doubly sure, then take a pan of something You know, you could even build, if you think the chimney's sound enough to stand it, just build a tiny little fire in there with some wet paper that will smoke. And that smoke will likely, if there are bats hanging up high in the chimney that are just using it for shelter, that'll drive them out. Or some ammonia or something like that, or moth flakes in the chimney box for a week or two to make sure that if there are any hanging out in there, that will drive them out. But I think the safest thing to do is just wait for some cold weather. Odds are good that they're out then on their own. Then go ahead and seal it up.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, emeritus, as a matter of fact, but still doing a lot of work in the wildlife area. So we're glad to have him with us today. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page, question or comment at the Larry Mueller Show. And our previous caller had made a comment or had a question about geese. And he'll see a whole bunch of geese on one pond, and then there's a pond nearby. And
no geese.
No geese. Why?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities that I can think of, depending on the spatial separation, and especially this time of year. For example, around my home in Oregon, there are ponds right on the edge of town that are covered with geese. Quarter of a mile down the road, there's a pond with no geese. Well, goose season is open, and the geese very quickly learn which ponds they're safe on and which ponds they're not safe on. That's one factor. Another factor, geese like to be able to walk out of a pond on a grass or open area. So a pond that might have a little deeper water or is surrounded by brush or shrubbery may look good to us, but it looks lousy to a goose. They want certain conditions in the pond, maybe some food plants, maybe some shallow depths, maybe easy access to getting out of the pond. They don't sit in the water all the time. They like to sleep up on the grass. It's usually related to the structure of the pond or whether they feel safe or whether they don't.
Yeah.
And there's probably other explanations too, but I think those are the two big ones.
Is that
so hopefully Ben is still listening.
Yeah, I hope so too. I'm thinking about our lake home. We had shrubbery and so forth along the shoreline, whereas our next-door neighbor did not.
And his lawn was covered with geese.
His lawn was covered with geese, and ours had none.
Yeah. And that's actually
not only geese, but what they leave, they deposit a lot.
And that's actually a management strategy for nuisance geese, is to plant vegetation that they find unacceptable to either walk through or roost in, and you can protect yourself a little bit. But an open lawn adjoining water is like a big, hey, geese, come on over.
Eric in Monona. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just had I didn't have a question, but I just had a quick kind of funny urban wildlife story to share. I live very close to the Monona Golf Course, and it's a 9-hole course, and I don't play very often, but I had heard about there was a pair of foxes that had taken up residence in a brush pile. On one of the holes, and sure enough, when I was golfing a couple of years ago with a friend of mine, I had heard that the foxes would come out and actually steal your golf ball off the course, and I'll be darned if, sure enough, my friend teed off and had a pretty good drive, and that fox came right out of the den, grabbed that golf ball, and brought it right back into the den. And you know, he cursed as much as he could. I can't repeat any of that on the air. But he teed up again, and sure enough, second drive, that same fox came right back out, grabbed that ball, and brought it back into his den. And it was we told the folks at the clubhouse about it, and they said that a couple of times where they've kind of cleared out that brush pile, they find hundreds of golf balls.
That's a pretty good story.
I love that story. I played that course. I actually just played that course about a week ago, as a matter of fact. Didn't see any fox, though.
Yeah, I haven't played it in a couple of years because the last time I played that course, I decided to take up fishing instead.
Ah, there you go.
That's, That's how good my golf game was.
Right. Well, that's a very good story. And over the years, I mean, we've had lots of stories about fox living in people's yards or adjoining parks or greenways or golf courses or what have you, and they just adapt very well to people. Their interest in the golf balls is a little curious, whether they view it as an intrusion on their turf or think, wow, I don't know where these round eggs keep coming from, but we'll keep collecting them. I don't know, but it's a good story.
We had an email from Christopher, and this goes back to the mentor hunt, which is this weekend, isn't it? Youth deer hunt?
Youth deer hunt is this weekend.
Is regular archery suspended, hunting season?
I don't think so.
I think
archery season is continuous. I mean, it shuts down for a bit during the gun deer season in November, but I don't think for the youth hunt that it's closed.
Okay.
I don't think. That's the best I can do.
Daniel in Rice Lake, hi to you.
Hello. When approaching deer by the roadside, I've experimented with honking the horn, which drives the deer away from the sound. I don't have to slow down so much on the approach. I believe if we practice sounding our horns at roadside deer, we would have far fewer deer-car collisions.
Oh. What do you think, Scott?
Well, it's a reasonable idea, Daniel. I mean, it's based on the supposition that people actually see the deer with enough lead time to blow the horn. And if you do, they'll usually move. Part of the difficulty is you're not altogether sure which way they're going to move because if some members of a family group or a doe group or whatever have already crossed the road, I think the remaining animals may be just as likely to dart across. But if you see the animals have a chance to get control of the car and blow the horn and they go the other way, hey, so much the better. But in some cases, it's a matter of, boy, the deer are just up out of the ditch and there before there's any opportunity to do anything. But, hey, if it saves one or two deer collisions a year, that's a good thing in terms of injuries and lost deer and lost money and a whole host of other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Daniel. Robin in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about, and I don't know the right pronunciation, if it's coyotes or coyotes.
It's your choice. Okay. It's like the potato thing.
All right. We have a farm. We raise beef cattle, and we've had people approach us wanting permission to come on our land to hunt or trap coyotes. And I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm told there are just tons of them in our area. I heard a few calls at night last year, but not this year. And I have seen a few in the spring. But I'm just wondering if it's a good thing to be killing them or if they play an important role in wildlife and the environment.
That's a tough question, Robin. For most folks involved in an agricultural setting, I think especially if they have livestock, they'd be just as happy if there were no coyotes around. I mean, coyotes have been implicated in all sorts of livestock problems for many, many years, and they've been pursued by humans with just about any means you can think of for just as many years, and yet over all those years, coyotes have continued to persist and extend their range, and they're real survivors. They're just a very adaptive, capable animal. In terms of the fundamental question, are they beneficial? You know, in the bigger scheme of things, they're great mousers. They take a lot of rabbits. They're an important mid-sized predator. So that's the niche that they fill. But as I say, when they start getting into the fringes of urban areas and there's concern that they're taking pet cats on the edges of a subdivision or in an agricultural setting that they're taking lambs or calves or someone's just concerned that they're contributing to fawn mortality in deer, there are lots of reasons why people might conclude that, hey, we could use a few less coyotes around here. And that becomes really something that an individual landowner, as in your case you are, if you decide, well, you know, I've learned to live with the coyotes. I occasionally like to see them or hear them howl or whatever. No big deal. If, on the other hand, you've had some negative experiences with them or your neighbors have or family members down the road, then you might have a little different attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's about the size of it.
All right.
I've heard that they do kill calves, but I wasn't sure if that was just something someone made up or if it really does occur.
It does occur, but it's usually smaller stock, but it can occur. And once something like that does happen, that tends to color people's viewpoint about coyotes fairly quickly.
Yeah. Thank you, Robin, for calling. Daryl had emailed us about coyotes, too, wondered the situation, the population, especially in the southwest portion of Wisconsin. I would say it's probably pretty good.
Coyotes do well wherever they happen to be. They're not as visible as one might think, and I think in many cases people see one run across the road and dismiss it as a stray dog in some cases, but they're certainly out there.
Heather in the town of Auburn, hi to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to address the issue of thousands of acres of industrial or frac sand mining.
You know what? I'm just now looking at at the clock on the wall here, and I suspect that your comments might take more than 15 or 20 seconds. So we're going to instead have you hold on, Heather, and we'll get your comments after we take a look at the news today. Scott Craven, our guest today, we're taking a look at the world of wildlife with him today. Caller Dennis, by the way, said that he's quite sure the archery hunt is still on during the mentored hunt, but archery hunters then have to wear blaze orange during that mentored hunt.
Good point, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Talking the world of wildlife, as I mentioned, with Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. And again, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back with Scott Craven right after this look at the news. Well, whether you're new to wildlife watching or you've been doing it all your life, it's great to have people around who know and care about our environment and are willing to talk about it. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're visiting with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, and we hear often from listeners who love getting to hear Scott explain animal behaviors and give some tips on what to watch for. And it helps, to appreciate what goes on here in our state. Scott, thanks for joining us again.
No problem, Larry. I enjoy being here.
We have several callers online. By the way, you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. I appreciate what you have to say. And so join us. And we were talking over the break here a little bit about the use of rodenticides, and certainly we want to use care when we use rodenticides, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that came up in the earlier call where there was an idea that, hey, pesticides, rodenticides in particular, are bad and cause problems for wildlife, which there are problems caused. There's no question about that. But rodenticides also fit into the picture of wildlife in terms of being in some settings, like the vole problems that we talked about in the fall. One of the only ways that on a large-scale setting, like a Christmas tree plantation or something like that, the producers can get any adequate control and allow them to produce their crops. So on the one hand, you might have some folks saying that, hey, we can use pesticides of all kinds, including rodenticides, with impunity and don't need to think about wildlife. That's not good.
No.
I mean, wildlife and other issues, including human health and safety and a whole host of things, have to be considered. But on the other hand, I think it's important to realize that pesticides do, rodenticides, as one of a number of different classes of pesticides, do have some place and are tightly controlled by regulations, purchase and use permits, instructions and labeling. And if used properly, there are certainly settings where they're valid and where problems to assorted wildlife, including raptors, should be minimized. But to advocate a blanket ban is just the other side of a coin. So anyway.
All right. Heather in the town of Auburn had joined us just before the news. Hi, Heather. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I'd like to address the issue of the thousands of acres of industrial sand mining that's being destroyed and its effect on our wildlife. This wildlife is being dispersed into other areas. We know that wildlife species will only survive on a certain amount of land. What happens when this land is being destroyed?
too many animals and not enough land will result in the destruction of that wildlife. Their breeding habits will be disrupted, and they now become susceptible to disease. If anybody's ever watched anything die of mange because there are too many species, for example, fox, coyote, in a particular area, it's an awful way for an animal to die.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just one thing. I'm just wondering, what's being addressed? Is anything being addressed to look at this problem?
Yeah. And Scott, you have not been directly involved in it, or have you been directly?
No, I haven't. But I guess the only comment that I'd make is that, yes, habitat is certainly being lost or degraded through this particular activity. But over the centuries, habitat has been lost or degraded to untold human land uses, whether it's frac sand mining, intensive agriculture, a big box store parking lot, a new subdivision on the edge of town. All of those activities, a new highway, all of those activities reduce, fragment, or degrade habitat. However, all of those activities are something that humans have decided they want for whatever reason, whether it's the frac sand mining and its impact on the energy industry and keeping gas under $12 a gallon or whatever, or whether it's, hey, we want the new big box store to keep our grocery prices down, or we want the new highway to get somewhere faster, or I want a lot in the new subdivision overlooking whatever. Unless and until enough people sway the tide, you know, politically or in terms of human interest, those activities will continue. And the wildlife professionals are left with attempting to mitigate the impacts of all of those activities over time. And people do the best they can, but certainly wildlife are displaced. All of the things that Heather mentioned could happen in terms of all very true, but they've been going on for a long time. That doesn't necessarily make them right, but eventually the buck stops with society and the vote and societal interests. And as long as there's a market or there's a marketplace environment for this activity, or the mining we talked about a little earlier, or all the other aspects of development, that's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, it really is. Heather, thank you for calling. I appreciate your call and your comments. It certainly makes some you make some interesting points. Bob and Krivitz, give you a chance next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. I heard you talk earlier about the geese and the geese problems that different people have. I live up at Krivitz, and I live down by Sheboygan, right across from the Wildlife Refuge at Terry Andry, and I worked part-time for the DNR for about 5 years before retiring from the power company. I had a problem with geese in my pond every year, and we take care of my mother-in-law, who's 89 years old and walks around this area. And needless to say, that's an animal that I think he poops when he sleeps, when he flies, when he lands, and when he eats.
Yeah.
So I tried chasing them out of there many times in spring, and not too successful at that. And my son, who's a carpenter, worked for Sir Gentle Cheese some years back, and he talked with the caretaker there with their pond, and he was using a coyote decoy.
Mm-hmm.
But he moved them every day, and it was successful. I bought the coyote decoys 3 years ago. I moved them every other day. It did not work at all. And I had a batch of, I had three geese in there plus six small ones. And eventually I chased them out between my black labs and shooting over the top of them with a shotgun. And I thought I scared them all away. Came back home, and here there's one chick that she did not take along back. But I caught the chick with a landing net, put her in my coat, walked back across to the wildlife refuge with knee boots on, and got up in the water up to my waist. And I just gently squeezed her. I don't hunt at all. Gently squeezed her until I got the response from another goose, and she came and picked them up. Right at the second year, I got pictures of the geese laying next to the coyote. Okay, right at the third year, which is this year, and I put them out just before the ice went out. Okay, just so I could get these snakes in the ground and have no problems whatsoever. Okay, and I don't move them. The only place you can buy these decoys is Gander Mountain. I tried Fleet Farm, and they don't, and they're expensive. They're well over $100.
Yeah, they're available in some of the garden supply catalogs too.
Okay, no, and I put them up this year. I put them up just when I could get in the frost, and they've been totally successful. Even sandhill cranes, or not sandhill, blue herons, would usually pick out the younger fish, and they'll sit up on top of the bridges coming into the pond. And make their head move in and out continuously and looking at them, and they'll take off.
Well, that's a good story, Bob. And like many things, timing is everything. And with a number of different scare tactics for wildlife control problems, getting the scare tactic out at the right point in the animal's life cycle is critical. I mean, putting out a coyote decoy when a family of geese has flightless young ones on a pond, they are not going to leave no matter what. But no. Getting them out early enough so that they're discouraged when they come in seems to be working for you. And those coyote decoys, and there are all sorts of quaint names for them, are available in a number of mail order garden catalogs. I think if you just Googled it, you'd probably find them too. So for other people who want to try them, they're out there along with floating alligator heads and assorted other things.
Yep. Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. You know, you mentioned a park, and the 2013 Friends of Wisconsin State Parks Gold Seal Award winners were just announced. And I think it's great to share information about this as where the best places to enjoy our state's natural areas. And I think it's kind of fun because for example, the best view from a tower is Peninsula State Park. Well, I would heartily agree with that.
Oh, that's a beautiful spot. That tower is great. And out overlooking the bay there with the sailboats anchored in it and the swimming beach and out over Green Bay, spectacular.
Yeah. And there we'll see what else. Best place to explore nature, the Richard Bong State Recreation Area. Another beautiful place.
Another nice place. I kind of like best place to hear an owl.
Yeah.
Governor Thompson State Park. Where is Governor Thompson State Park? I don't know.
Isn't it Madison? Isn't it?
I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. I can't tell. I right off the top of my head, somebody quick call and let us know.
I like best place for dog walking, too. I really like Whitefish Dunes up in Door County, and that's a beautiful park. I don't know if you can run your dogs on the beach or not, but maybe you can. And if you can, it is a beautiful setting. So
Whitefish Dunes, yeah, beautiful, beautiful park. And, you know, we do a lot of hiking, and the most challenging hiking trail mentioned, or the winner, was Kettle Moraine State Forest, the Pike Lake Unit Trail to Tower. I've been on that one. That is a pretty good it's a pretty good hike, that's for sure. So that's kind of cool. Best Historic Restoration Project, the Heritage Hill State Historic Park, Fort Howard Guard House Project. And let's see, the Best Friends Group website, Newport Wilderness Society.
Hmm.
So all those great places. I also wanted to mention while I was thinking about it, there are some public meetings this month on the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative. I don't know if you're familiar with that initiative, Scott, but there are some meetings set up to discuss it. October 15th in Hayward at the Hayward High School Auditorium. October 16th, it's in Rhinelander at the Quality Inn there. October 23rd, it's Oconomowoc at the High School Art Center. And those are the meetings, October 15th, 16th, and October 23rd. 15th, the first one at Hayward. So if you go online to the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative, you're going to find more information on that.
If you want to catch more walleyes, you'll be excited about the Wisconsin Walleye Initiative.
Yeah.
Because that's really the bottom line, is that the attempt is to get more walleyes into the state waters and therefore into people's frying pans.
Yeah, into people's frying pans. The bass have kind of overtaken the walleye, and I think people would like to get more walleye back in.
That's kind of interesting. You know, we've talked about the bass situation, and they changed the regulations up in our favorite lake chain and the Minocqua chain so that you could keep bass this year of any size to encourage people to take some bass out of the lake. And,
yeah.
You know, I spent a fair bit of time up there and talking to folks who had taken that to heart and were mixing a few bass fillets in with their other fish and their fish fries. I don't know, the conclusion I got was that, hey,
couldn't tell the difference.
Couldn't tell the difference. So maybe that'll put a little more pressure on some of these lakes that have or where the regulations change so that people can utilize the bass a little more effectively. And whether it was pickled bass or fried bass, it didn't seem to make much difference. So,
and here we've got on my Facebook page a photo from Karen, who says she's got a badger was on her yard in the middle of the day, wondering if that's normal. I'm trying to see, you know, the badger is...
Well, there he is, yeah. I think. It's kind of small.
Kind of small. It's hard. It's, it looks, from my perspective, like a badger. And badgers are pretty hard to...
Well, I'm about 2 inches from the screen, Larry.
You're about 2 inches from
even
the screen.
Even with my glasses on, it's small, but it does from the
you
tail.
You need to be
all
down by the microphone.
Even from the tail and the low slung body, yeah, it sure looks like a badger. So,
and but there it is running around the middle of the day. Yeah.
Hey.
Normally, they're more nocturnal.
The kind of beautiful weather we've been having, everything's out running around in the middle of the day.
Yeah, yeah, it is absolutely amazing weather for sure. And there was a beautiful shot of a hummingbird moth, which is really a hawk moth.
Yep, hawk moth. That's a beauty.
From William, thank you for sending that. It was a really beautiful photo there, and. Someone was also wondering, great places to see the migrations now. This person is worried about the state parks being shut down, but there are no state parks
shut
down.
No, I don't think there's any effect on the state parks.
No, it's just the federal where we're having the problem. And
even with that, it was my impression that whether it's the national parks or wildlife refuges or whatever, where there are normal state highways that bisect the properties, they're still wide open. So, for example, you'd be driving up at Horican Marsh, you'd be driving along Highway 49 on the north end of the federal refuge and could still see or do or whatever else you you wish. So,
yep, there you go. Victor in West Dallas, hello, thank you for calling.
Hey, what's your feelings of the spiders and the spider webs? As a macro photographer, I put some of my stuff on your webpage, you know, Facebook, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Like white crab spider and the praying mantis that everybody got scared about. What's your feeling of the spiders? I have found as a macro, 65-member macro photographer, they collect so many different insects, including what I just filmed the other day of a yellow jacket that was caught in a web. So what's your feeling on spiders?
I like spiders.
Well, then we'll have to agree to differ because I'm a confirmed arachnophobe. I'm not real fond of spiders. I don't know why, because I can't think of much else that I'm concerned with in the natural world. But in terms of the webs, you know, as I was sitting out on the farm the other day, it was sunrise and there was a lot of dew on some pretty neat webs along the edge of the field in the early sunlight. It was spectacular. So I would say in answer to Victor's question, appreciation for spider webs, I'm right there with you, Victor. Appreciation for the spiders making them, I'm less enthusiastic.
Well, I like spiders, but we all have our own little fears. Yeah. I heard this morning Coach Anderson, who is the coaches the football team, has a fear of horses.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So there's, you know, and he's readily admitted it. He said, you know, we all have our fears, and he was just one person who's not a big fan of horses. So there you go.
Hmm.
Sean and Stanley, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thanks for taking my call. My question concerns fishers. I noticed earlier this year out in our wooded area of our property that it seemed awfully quiet, like there weren't many squirrels or birds or anything around. So I set up a wildlife camera, and it was, but the only thing I got pictures of were these giant weasels, essentially, and I was informed that they were fishers, and that's why there were no other animals around, and I was just curious if fishers took up residence on property, or if they were nomadic and would move along, you know, in the winter, or what, and I'll just listen on air for the
All right.
Well, fishers have done very well in Wisconsin. since a a low point back 40 or 50 years ago, and Fishers and Martins were restored at about the same time. Martins have not fared well, but Fishers did fantastically, and they can certainly cover a lot of ground because they've started to turn up in southwestern and southern counties on occasion. But the stronghold is still the northern part of the state. They're a big member of the weasel family, beautiful animal, beautiful fur. And I think if they find suitable habitat or for animals that are resident in a particular forested tract in, say, the northern third of the state, they're pretty much there. Whether or not they can, an individual or several fishers can result in, the depletion of, all other species to the point where you're experiencing silent spring in your woods, I question that a little bit. But I will say that fishers among various predatory members of the wildlife community have as diverse a diet as any other animal you can imagine. They'll eat just about anything they can get a hold of. So while you may be fingering squirrels or some other species, they'll eat just about anything, and they're very effective predators. So certainly in a local site, they may suppress the squirrel population for a while, but no effective predator or parasite or whatever can completely destroy its food supply, or they themselves become unsuccessful. So they'd have to move on if they've been that successful, which I doubt. But they are very effective predators, so I can see where they might slow things down for a while.
Mm-hmm. Rick in Gays Mills, hi.
Hi. I've been watching for about a month and a half one of those conical gray big wasp's nests about a half a mile into the woods behind my house.
Mm-hmm.
It was low, maybe only 4 or 5 feet off the ground in a little branchy tree. A week ago, I went out there, excuse me, and I walked by and I thought, wait, I didn't see it. I went back to look for it. It was totally shredded all over the ground, a few little shreds left on the little tree that it was on. Excuse me, but it was totally shredded in a mess.
So what would have caused that, Scott?
Darn good question, Larry. the two animals were kind of far south to be thinking about bears, but that's a possibility. But skunks and bears are the two animals that come to mind most quickly in terms of harassing various types of bees' nests and so forth to get the larvae as a food source, or in the case of honeybees, honey. So those would be a couple possibilities, but there are probably others too. But I don't know. I guess if I had to take a shot, I'd be tempted to blame a skunk, but
yeah,
could be a number of different things.
Skunk, yeah, that's probably a pretty good guess. Somebody wondered about cicadas. Todd said, I heard the last of the cicadas last evening. I was impressed by its diligence in calling for a mate, but had thought they all died off about a couple of weeks back. And just wondering about how long will a cicada live?
I have no idea. We better wait until Phil's on again and pose that question.
I have no idea either. And
I mean, it was my impression they're a pretty short-lived insect, maybe weeks at best. But
yeah. And Governor Nelson State Park is located just west of Crivets.
Governor Nelson or Governor Thompson?
I'm sorry, Governor Thompson. State Park. Governor Thompson State Park, just west of Crivets. Bob, who had called earlier, had worked there. So, and Phil is on next Wednesday.
There we go. So we'll answer the mystery of the cicadas.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist at the University of Wisconsin Extension, emeritus professor there. Great to have him along. Tomorrow, October is National Mental Health Month. So we're going to find out how to identify and address stress in children and adults. And then at 11:45, Frank Armstrong joins us to talk about saving for retirement. He'll explain all the different ways to do it and which might be the best one for you. So we'll look forward to that as well. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.